So, in coming to the final chapter of Ruth, it's kind of like reaching the summit of a journey where we get a much better vantage point to see and to look out and see the purposes of God. And you know what I mean? If you're a walker or a climber, those times when you get to see what lies beyond. In chapter 4, we get to see beyond the horizon of this one particular family. We get to see where it's all been going. In the providence of God, we get to see the bigger picture that we had not clearly seen before. I've got 5 headings. Seems a wee bit much, but it really takes in the whole story so far. The hopelessness we feel, the self-reliance we exhibit, the trust that we're called to, the love that bears the cost, but ultimately, the Lord. This book is about the Lord who does not leave us without a redeemer. He may bring us many tears. He may bring us hard times. He may bring us to the end of ourselves. Yes, but he does not leave us without a redeemer. And that's the message of chapter 4, and it's the message of the book of Ruth. So first of all, the hopelessness we feel. As we've seen, chapter 1 begins in darkness. It was the days when the judges ruled. In other words, a thoroughly godless time to live. You know that if you've read the book of Judges. It forms the backdrop to this beautiful story of Ruth. You get to the end of the book of Judges and you'd be forgiven for thinking, that's it. I mean, there is no hope at all for Israel. There can't be. It's too far gone. The people of God have sunk to new levels of wickedness. What hope can there be for such a people in covenant with a holy God? And so Ruth begins in this darkness with a famine, and famine was often a way that God used to discipline his people in the Old Testament. Would they return to him? What we get is a family not crying to the Lord, but rather leaving. They leave the land of promise in search of blessing elsewhere with a people whose God is not the Lord. There's no light on the horizon just yet. Then the husband dies. It ain't looking good for this Israelite family. Will they cry out to God? The two sons marry a Moabite woman. That doesn't bode too well. Moabites did not worship God and actually oppressed God's people. It still ain't looking good. Then the two sons die. And Naomi repeatedly urges her daughters-in-law to go back to their old people and their old gods. It would appear that this story of Ruth is simply carrying on where the book of Judges left off. It's dark, it's hopeless, and Naomi is exceedingly bitter. I went away full, she said, and the Lord has brought me back empty, she says when she arrives back in Bethlehem. She still believed in God, is the Almighty. But for now, she could see no hope. Who's going to carry on the name of her family? Her two sons are dead. No heir. In ancient Israel, it was considered a great misfortune if your name disappeared. It was kind of like being consigned to the dustbin of history. Your identity, your place, your prospects, all kind of snuffed out of existence if you lost your name, if it was not perpetuated. The Almighty has brought calamity upon me, she says in chapter 1. And sometimes it feels like that, doesn't it? I mean, in one sense, Naomi is absolutely right. God is sovereign, and this is what she has been dealt by the Almighty. But it would seem that Naomi's bitterness keeps her from seeing that actually God is not against her. He is not against her. He has afflicted her. He has brought misfortune upon her, but there's more. There's more going on here than Naomi yet sees. And while nothing in this life is going to make up for the depth of her loss, God is nevertheless working for her good. And the sun gradually rises as we read on in the book of Ruth. He gives Naomi such a devoted daughter-in-law that, as we see now in chapter 4, she proves herself to be better than 7 sons, as she is told in chapter 4. He brings Naomi home to a harvest at the end of chapter 1. He then puts Boaz, her close relative, in the right place at the right time for her blessing in chapter 2. God is not against Naomi. Indeed, through Boaz, he pours out unexpected, abundant blessing upon both Naomi and Ruth in chapters 2 and 3. Isn't it true that sometimes we can neither see nor anticipate the good things that God is doing? I mean, sometimes we just can't see it. And maybe that's you today. Maybe you're like, you know, I just don't see what good can come of this situation, whatever it may be. I don't see how God is working for my good right now. And God forgive me, I just don't see that his mercies are new every morning. I mean, maybe they are, but I don't feel it. I don't get it. And I fear for the future. I just can't see past this mountain of despair and hopelessness. And maybe that's you today. And if it is, then this book is written for you. And it's also written for everyone who is therefore tempted to do what Naomi does in chapter 3. In chapter 3, as we learned last week, Naomi takes matters into her own hands. I've called this the self-reliance we exhibit. The hopelessness we feel and the self-reliance we exhibit. We can imagine Naomi thinking to herself, Boaz and Ruth. Ruth and Boaz. I never could have imagined it when we were coming back from Moab. But boy, this Boaz, he's been so kind. And imagine if I can get these two together. And if I could work it, you know, he could be our kinsman redeemer. He could marry Ruth. And he could buy back the land that was my late husband's land. And he could do it for our sake. And we could be maintained from the land. And more to the point, he and Ruth could have a son who could be an heir to that property. And that way our family name could be perpetuated. My dead son, Mahlon, could have an heir after all through a kinsman redeemer like Boaz. Yes, yes. You know, I've got to make this happen. I've got to make it happen. I don't care how it happens, but I've got to make it happen. What can I do? And we only wonder if her conscience told her, hey, Naomi, sister, it's in God's hands, you know. Don't go do anything rash. Don't go do anything foolish. God knows what he's doing, so, you know, trust him. Pray about it. Go chat to Boaz, maybe. See what he's thinking. Keep your head here. But it's hard, isn't it, when you feel like you're on your own? When you think God is maybe against you or doesn't care for you, we start to rely on ourselves. Our plans, our ideas, our will and purpose. It may not be God's, but hey, as long as you get what you want. Naomi has a plan. Let me see. Boaz will be winnowing barley tonight on the threshing floor. He'll eventually eat and drink and go to bed there. If I got Ruth to go down there late on, you know. No, it's not appropriate. Not appropriate for a woman to go down there, especially at that time. What would people say? Although, if she's very careful, and if I send her there looking as good as I know she can look, and if she's wearing that perfume that she has, bada bada bing. How could Boaz refuse to marry her? Of course, you know, there is potentially the problem that Boaz might be tempted to have her right there and then. You know, he's in bed, she's looking great, smelling great. Oh, but then that wouldn't really be my fault, and hopefully he would agree to be her husband. And not only are we, when we read Naomi's plan, not only are we thinking, what? This way, Naomi? Not only that, but she also must have known about the nearer kinsman, right? I mean, there's a nearer kinsman. She must have known about him. I mean, she was a closer relative than Boaz. Boaz knew about him. So even aside from the very questionable situation that Naomi puts Ruth into, how was it right to be ignoring the nearer kinsman? It was not Boaz's prerogative, first and foremost. It was this other guy's prerogative. But sometimes we just don't want to think about the right thing to do or the trusting thing to do. Sometimes we just want to rely on ourselves. I mean, waiting on God is just so hard and risky. I mean, God might not do what we want God to do. So we take matters into our own hands. We're just going to get things done. Take matters into our own hands. I think that's what we see in chapter 3 with Naomi. But then at the end of chapter 3 and with chapter 4 in Boaz, we see something altogether different. We see the trust that we're called to, the hopelessness we feel, the self-reliance we exhibit, and the trust that we're called to. In Boaz, we see the kind of trust in God that says, Lord, not my will, but your will be done. Do you ever pray like that? Not my will, but your will be done. Boaz wants to marry Ruth. We saw that in chapter 3. He wants to marry her, but he also knows that there's a closer relative. That it's, first of all, someone else's responsibility, not his. And as a man of integrity, he will not trample over someone else's prerogative. Now, if it were me, admittedly, I might have said to Ruth, yes, it is true. I am your kinsman redeemer, so let's get married immediately before anyone else might have other ideas. But no, Boaz is not going to pull a fast one like that. You can imagine, though, some of his friends, what they might have said. Boaz, buddy, come on. Seize the moment, big guy. You can't let it pass. You can't risk the possibility of missing out on the girl of your dreams. Be true to yourself. Isn't that the modern mantra? You got to be true to yourself. I mean, you know, do what you need to do to be happy. Do it or you'll regret it forever. So there's a closer relative. Big deal. Forget about him. Sure, he's probably happy enough. Don't say a word. Why go out of your way to involve him when it's not even on his radar right now? Don't be daft. Doesn't love rule? Marry the girl. Don't delay. We justify ourselves very, very easily, don't we? We actually talk ourselves into putting ourselves first, as if that was the right and the true thing to do. But Boaz has a deeper love, a love for God that makes him willing to sacrifice the desires of his own heart. He will not plow on ahead and grab what he wants if it would mean dishonoring his Lord. No, he won't do it. So he goes to the near kinsman, and he's entirely honest. And as readers, there's a part of us thinking, oh no. No, we can't have the story ending with the other guy marrying Ruth. You know, we don't want that. That would be terrible. But it really could have happened. And sometimes when you trust God and do the right thing, it really does mean that things don't work out the way you long for. Sometimes that's what happens. And if anyone tells you otherwise, they're lying. And so as Hilton said last week, chapter 3 ends on something of a cliffhanger. Will the nearer kinsman be willing to bear the cost of redemption? The answer, we know, of course, the answer is no. Because the closer relative simply does not have the love that bears the cost. And that's my fourth heading. The hopelessness we feel, the self-reliance we exhibit, the trust that we're called to, and the love that bears the cost. According to verse 6 in chapter 4, the kinsman redeemer, the nearer kinsman, simply refuses to endanger his own estate. He's happy to buy the land of Elimelech, verse 4. Yeah, I'll buy it. You know, more land for me, win-win. Until he discovers that he would then need to marry Ruth in order to maintain the name of the dead with his property. Is that the time? Yeah, I gotta go. Suddenly he doesn't want to know. He's happy to buy the land if it'll then be in his name, but he doesn't want to buy the land for the sake of someone else's name. No way, where's the benefit in that? He thinks, and of course, there is no benefit. It's a fairly simple principle, but let's not miss it. When you have love, you're willing to bear whatever the cost. When you don't, you're not. Love is what made Boaz willing to be the kinsman redeemer. He loved God, he loved Ruth. Now, it's one thing to note all of that. It's one thing to say, yes, we too are guilty of self-reliance. Yes, we too need to trust God like Boaz did. Your will be done. Yes, we too need to love sacrificially. Yes, yes, yes. I know. But where does it come from? This trust and this love. How do we become people who really live like that? The answer is ultimately in seeing what the woman said in verse 14 in chapter 4. When they say, "Praise be to the Lord, who this day has not left you without a redeemer." They trusted him for that. You see, if all this book did was remind us of the hopelessness we feel, and the self-reliance we exhibit, and the trust that we're called to, and the love that bears the cost, I still might leave from here utterly depressed, only too aware of my ongoing failures. But this book is not ultimately about setting an example through Ruth or Boaz. If it was, it would end in verse 13. Instead, we're pointed twice to the messianic King David. Obed is born as a redeemer for Naomi. He'll carry on the family name. From Obed comes Jesse. From Jesse comes David. Verse 17, and that is the climax of the whole book, which is then repeated in the genealogy of verses 18 to 22. What was God doing all along? What was God doing? Here's what he was doing. He was raising up someone to do for his people what they could not do for themselves. Not merely Obed for Naomi, but a king for a whole nation. And of course, you and I, on this side of the cross, we see the even greater fulfillment, don't we? Not Obed, not David even, but from David, the King of Kings, who would redeem a people for himself from every tribe and nation and language and tongue through his death on the cross. It's the bigger picture. And there's always a bigger picture. And wherever we are in the Bible, the bigger picture is ultimately not the story of what we must do for God. The bigger picture in the Bible is always the story of what God does for us. And that's why we can read this amazing book and not be left in hopelessness. You know, you take the first point, the hopelessness we feel. This book points us to the one who was plunged into utter darkness for your sake and mine. We're not alone. We're not abandoned. Or take the second point, the self-reliance we exhibit. This book points us to the one who himself was tempted to self-reliance. You remember the story when he was hungry in the wilderness? Satan tempted him to turn stones into bread. He could have done that. Jesus could have done that. But for my sake and yours, he did not succumb. He knew that man does not live on bread alone, but on the word of God. He achieved the obedience that you and I could never achieve. And he did it for us. Or take the third point, the trust that we're called to. This book points us to the one who trusted our Father in heaven without compromise at every single point where we failed to do so. And he did it for you. And he did it for me. And the fourth point, the love that bears the cost. This book points us to the one whose love for you and me was so unfathomably deep that he left behind all the glory of heaven and became a servant who would suffer and die in our place, bearing the wrath of God that we deserved, and he did it for you and he did it for me. That is how we can find the power to live more like Boaz and Ruth rather than like Naomi or the unnamed kinsman. And therefore you and I can echo those words in verse 14. Praise be to the Lord who has not left us without a redeemer. May he, the ultimate redeemer, Jesus, become famous in verse 14. Do you see that? That's the prayer in verse 14. May he become famous. Well, may Jesus become famous, not only in Israel, but in Malahide, in Howth, in Clongriffin, in every inch of Ireland, in every part of the universe. May Jesus become famous. May his name be renowned. That's what we're about. That's what our church is about. That's why we exist. That the name of Jesus may be renowned. He, verse 15, will renew your life and sustain you. He is the one, the only one, who is hope for the hopeless, to whom this whole book and the whole Bible points. So, you know, whatever your struggles today, don't worry if you can't see the good that God is working in and through your circumstances. He may be working good for people in generations you've not yet met or even contemplated. Whatever is going on with you, it's not the end of the story. It's not the end of the story. May God help us even in our pain and our worries to praise him that he has not left us without a redeemer. To him be the glory forever and ever.